If sometimes, you know, you get a gift, or you buy a gift for a child, and it's one of these kits, right, with all the directions and instructions. And if you follow it carefully and put it together, then you produce one of these, model planes, and it can fly with the remote control and so on and so forth, right? Now, you imagine if the kid got it, put it all together, and it's flying, and then he really feels like he created an airplane. So, you know, you smile at him, and you really create the airplane. It was all there. All you did was follow the directions, correct? And you put it together. You did not create. It's not as though you went out and you created something new. Now, in my opinion, that's basically all that anybody could do in this universe. Of course, it's more complicated. It's more complicated, but basically the individual who created airplanes or cars or whatever, that's basically what they were doing.
But the thing comes with instructions.
I'm sorry?
Well, the kit comes with instructions.
So that's just a quantitative difference between the two.
It's
a difference in degree. I mean, you have a mind. There's all the thousands of years of scientific research preceding you, which is instruction.
Yeah.
You see? So the steps that you took, it's akin. I'm not saying it's akin. It's not identical. Now we're just arguing which is more difficult. I can give you instructions that are more difficult.
But
you
didn't come with
instructions. That are less difficult. What?
Even if the kid didn't come with
instructions, you had to
figure it out.
You just figured it out.
Yeah, but that's
I am not saying that there's no element of creativity in man. That's a lie. It is true. God takes note of this inspiration. That's why God says, Kuruvu, right? When Milu S. Arch will kick you up. God is giving man an area, an arena in which to use his creativity. But the point is, of course there is room for human creativity. But when a person exercises that creativity and he brings about certain results, right, then the emotion that he has should be the appropriate emotion, and the appropriate emotion would be a tremendous sense of awe and wonder at the greatness of the Creator. And that's where the focus would be, and the recognition that the role that he played is very minimal. And by the way, in that endeavor to utilize man's abilities and to apply it to the world, to develop the world, to transform the world, and so on and so forth, technological progress, you have to realize also that the yachid, the individual, is very, very minute. First of all, the human role is very, very minute in the entire thing, because God is the creator. God constructed the entire thing, the universe, and planted in the universe all these ideas, and the universe was designed in such a way that it's amenable to a tremendous amount of development. That's something we don't realize. I mean, that's an amazing thing, that it's subject to constant change and improvement and development. No human can construct such an environment. But you can construct a building, whatever, and how much room is there to change it around? Up to a point, you can make certain changes, otherwise you're going to have to destroy the whole structure. And God created man, and God endowed you with the capacity, with the code, so you can tie in, you can clue into what's going on out there. And if you follow those directions, I mean, how much are you really responsible for? Very, very little. And even with that, there's very little that you as an individual can do. Because without the society, without civilization, without schools, and without teachers, and without... When you realize that, how small the role of the individual is in the scheme of things, then you will not suffer from egotism. You'll have your attitude towards yourself will be healthy, if it is in line with the reality of things, then you won't have this crazy feeling about yourself. You'll feel happy about what you did, there's nothing wrong with that. But as I said, that'll be the same thing, like a person goes to go to the doctor rather than not go to the doctor. He got to the, now he's happy that he was cured. That he uses his sense, he was intelligent, and he chose a good doctor. He didn't follow his emotions. His emotions was led him to go to somebody else. So how much are you going to feel proud of yourself? The doctor did all the work. You were just intelligent enough to go to the correct doctor. But maybe the reason why Max, the Rambam says that a person should actually view his his own ability as a left. That's an actually, right? That was the question.
No.
He says that humbleness is where a person views his own ego as his own say-so as being less than actually in the scheme of things. It is perhaps for this very reason. Because this emotion is so powerful and dangerous that it's not enough sometimes. It's not enough to simply if you try to evaluate it. Some people can, but usually there's a tendency to overestimate yourself if you have to go counter. Even though it's not, to follow as a protective device, you have to go counter to that and to actually always adopt the attitude of humbleness. In other words, a certain attitude of humbleness. You can't, in other words, in certain areas you can try to get an accurate picture of where you are in the situation, where you are in the scheme of things. But he says, so if in fact it is, if your attitude towards yourself is in line with the scheme of things, then it's all right. He thinks it's exceedingly difficult, and you're going to trick yourself. If you're going to set out to do it that way, you're probably going to fail. So it's always better to assume that your role is very low. So it's always better to underestimate yourself. In other words, I'm saying perhaps that's what it means. As a practical guide to avoid the dangers of overestimation, it is probably a better policy to underestimate yourself. That doesn't mean to say that you have to feel like a nothing. That's a different attitude. I mean, but in terms of estimating yourself, you see, since the natural tendency of man is to overestimate himself, right? While it is true that from a philosophical standpoint, if he did not overestimate himself, and he didn't underestimate himself, but had an accurate picture of himself, that would be proper and appropriate. That would be true humility. But since it's very difficult practically for a person to have that, because once he's engaged in the activity of estimating himself, then the emotion to overestimate himself is going to kick in. So then it's best, practically speaking, to always adopt the policy of underestimating himself. That's from a practical standpoint, you're better off. You see? Because you're not going to lose anything. You're not going to lose anything by it. You see? And you will avoid, I think what it means is that in either case, Max, you avoid the danger of overestimating. Look at this. Now, once a person is engaged in the activity of trying to estimate himself, and he's, of course, going to be affected by this emotion, so then he's very, very likely to... Very likely, the likelihood is that he will wind up overestimating himself. So therefore, it's better to adopt an attitude of underestimating himself, in a sense. That's more safe. That's much more safe. And it's really, there's no danger. There's no downside. The downside, of course, would be like this. The downside would be if a person feels inferior, that's something else. That's not what he's talking about. But it's to say that he's absolutely lacking in self-confidence. That's different. He's not saying that. Because the person needs a certain amount of confidence in himself in order to function properly. You see, but the problem with confidence is different. It turns out that people that have an overestimation of themselves, they have a problem with confidence. Because, you see, a part of them knows that it's not real. You see, that since they have to maintain a certain image, because then they feel very nervous, because they know it's not real, so then they're subject to tremendous pressure. So then they don't have genuine self-confidence. Okay? But if a person has an accurate estimate of his place in the scheme of things, it's accurate, so then the type of confidence that goes with that is more of a natural, a realistic. It's a realistic type of thing. Just from a cursory glance at the Ravalman Rambam, he didn't seem to be that concerned. The concern is not so much that a person has an accurate picture of where he stands, rather than that he doesn't have an inaccurate picture on the wrong side. In other words, the thing, what you get from here is that we're just concerned that you shouldn't be overestimating yourself. Because if you underestimate yourself, there's no real loss. There is no real loss. Because as a piece of knowledge, it's not that important. Right? the important thing is, really the important thing is that when a person considers the magnitude of the universe, he has a sense of love for the Creator, not for man. We want to go, we're not interested. You see, we're not interested in man. We're not interested in human greatness. Okay? So therefore the question of the role of man in the scheme of things is not really that important from a collective point of view. But it is important because since we are people and we have egos, we always think about that. You see? So it's not an issue which you can practically avoid. It's something you want to think about. But that's what he's saying. But then once you start to think about it, okay, you can think about it. But there's a danger, and that danger is overestimation of self, because that's the source of all evil. So to avoid that, it's essential that a person either has an accurate, and if he has an accurate estimate of where he stands in the scheme of things, he won't get that disease. But if we can't trust him to come to that, then learn better, he should always underestimate himself. It's a practical piece of advice. The thing of a muscle would be, like a person doesn't want to get into fight. No, of course, unless it's for a righteous cause. But in general, you don't want to get into fight with people. Keep trying to avoid fights, the useless fights, needless fights. Now, that's what I'm talking about. You know, you go through the streets, there's gangs, you don't want to get into fights. That's just one policy. What do you need it for? Okay? So, part of this has to do with the fact that, you know, you don't want to get into situations where you're going to get killed or hurt. Alright, so the idea would be that a person has a completely accurate sense of his own strength and his scheme of things, where he stands, what situations he can handle and what situations he can't handle. Right, like a policeman, whatever. And you have to have a certain sense of what you can handle, what you can't handle. So, in this area, I would say either you should have an accurate sense of your own abilities, but since it's very, very difficult, it's very powerful, you have this, you know, this ego, this macho kind of feeling that, you know, you should be a tubby eye, and that's going to cause you distortion. So you tell your kids, better view yourself as being a weak guy. Of course, when you have to fight, you have to fight, and that's something else I'm saying, but in those areas where you can avoid a fight. Right? And if you truly regard yourself as being weak, if you really truly regard yourself as being weak, you'd walk away, right? But then it's a matter of policy. Assume most of the time that, you know, underestimate your strength. Always underestimate your strength in that way, and you'll be better off. There's many areas in life where you'll find that to be true, that people get into tremendous trouble because they overestimate their own ability, their own luck, and so on and so forth. And as a matter of practical policy, you're probably better off underestimating. You see, you'd be better off that way. What David is saying is that in any endeavor to estimate yourself, you should err on the side of assuming that, you know, that there's a good policy. On the side of lowering yourself, so to speak. That's true. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with you. You see, here, you have to understand, of course, the problem I think everybody's having is that we always were concerned about the truth, accuracy. You have to know, when we're talking about objective reality and what the true idea is, that's where we're so concerned about accuracy. Over here, it's really not an important issue altogether. It's not even something really, I don't think, the truly humble people are humble not because they're working on trying to find out exactly where they stand in the scheme of things, because they're not even thinking about the issue altogether. The ultimate cure of the disease is where a person is totally captivated by the beauty of the creation, of the external world. He's totally involved in the study of God's chachma, so he's not even thinking about himself. You see? In fact, a person could spend his entire life and never give a thought to this issue. That would be the healthiest thing, because really, well, what importance is it? It has no importance. And to be involved in this, all these, you see, really, society is totally immersed in this, in the human ego. That's why all these discussions around every topic, who is the best in this, who is the greatest athlete, who is the best in the other thing, who is second best, and all these arguments are a total waste of time. Because what difference does it make? So it's not an object where we have to find out what the truth is. It's not an object of investigation, you see. We're talking about truth, we're talking about truth with regard to issues that are really significant, but not insignificant things, which are completely, the whole thing is arbitrary and it's nonsensical. So Nevertheless, however, it does become a problem for a person because the person is always operating with a certain sense of self. So, therefore, I'm saying what we're talking about over here is adopting an attitude. So if a person adopts an attitude that he's not that great, and even if it should turn out that he's underestimating himself, underestimation of himself is better. Since people suffer from overestimation of the self, then the proper policy would be to underestimate yourself. That would make you happier. That's a happier existence. That's all. The attitude a person should always have is Ikushani La'atmi Me'oni. That man, the individual, is capable of doing something, and he should be happy with that, but in his own mind he has to magnify. Man is always involved in the magnification of his own role. And you know, you see that in every area. Even in the family, in a relationship, in children, in the school, you always magnify the role that you play, and you always sort of downplay the role that everybody else plays. And you don't, and that's such a source of a tremendous amount of unhappiness, but also in terms of human relations, there's tremendous envy and fighting going on. A person is within families. The children always rebel against, why do they rebel against their parents? Because the parents get everything to them. The parents are, you see, it's an affront to their own narcissism. The person would have, that's an essential component to keep it out of the end. The person recognizes that through keep it out of the end, it's really gratitude to the Creator that he's nothing. Without his parents, he wouldn't have existence. He wouldn't have physical existence. He wouldn't have developed. He wouldn't have had a sense. He wouldn't have anything. And you see, a person comes into the picture. It's like somebody else built up the business. He did all the work. He fought all the battles. And now you come in. I'm sure you've seen this all the time. Now, probably in the world of business, and you know, somebody looking at you is laughable. Where you know. The father set him up and started out as a vice president, this guy, and then he said, and this guy's acting like this is his thing. He has the attitude like this is our guilt, and he even played for the father. But that's not an isolated case. Everybody, the mechanism what that person is using exists within all of us. We just see it as being grotesque in certain situations. But that's the attitude, that is the proper attitude that a person should have towards anything that he accomplishes. And she always gets credit for Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's the idea of Bitta Kamazon. You had a meal, you feel satisfied, immediately you give credit to you go back to the source. And then you have, then you realize, why? Why is it? Now, a person feels because, what do you mean, why? He doesn't answer the question. Of course, it's the way things should be because I'm extremely important and I have to have my pleasure. I mean, it's only right. It's only right that the world should be this way. So immediately going to business and loving, we find that it's not. There's a reason why there's food out there and you partake of it and you have this good feeling of satisfaction. It's not because of anything innate in you. It's not because of anything innate in you. Okay? So you're getting out of that infantile, you know, distorted magnification of self. Another subject of jokes, making jokes about different groups, you know, putting down groups and doing anything wrong philosophically. So just first of all, I just want to say this from the halakhic standpoint, it seems that the halakhic issue would be when you're really causing another individual pain. Now, if there's a member of a group present and you make fun out of that group, not out of that person particularly, you make fun out of that group, but he himself feels hurt by it because he's a member of that group, then that's also. Because there's a halacha like that. What's the halacha? There's a ger, yara adasara dori, a ger up to 10 generations. You're not allowed to embarrass a Gentile to his face. In other words, in a way, you know, the Jews have these, Jews have their own expressions too. I mean, you're aware of this, you know. Jews always complain if anybody makes fun out of them, picks on them. But Jews pick on other groups as well. For example, the Jews do it in a more subtle way. The worst insult that a Jew can say about a Gentile is a Gayish Akap. He has a Gayish Akap. The Gayish Akap means it's a Gentile mind. It's a Gentile mind. That's the worst insult. Because the Kadesh Akap is more of a put down than all these other things. The things that people hurl at the Jews, the put downs, or that they hurl at Pro-life, pro-life goes on minimal, because they're not really that significant. But this is a real wipeout. Because the mind is the whole essence. What you're saying is really like subhuman, basically, in a sense. The guy is a crap. It's not really taken seriously, right? Nevertheless, the Jews always say this with a certain amount of pride, you know, like a certain pride, like we are the... Yeah, we're the real ones. Yeah, and to the contrary, is that a real Yiddishkeit, a Jewish mind, is the greatest compliment. And I'm saying, if you were to say such a thing in front of a geir, that's the point that I'm trying to make. Let's say we had a geir here, a convert, and then you were making fun about somebody else, and say, ah, it's a cup. So that would sting this individual. You see, because even though he's converted, on an emotional level, he regards himself as coming from the same stock. You see? So, I just want to point out that would be prohibited. But for the halakhic problem of making fun out of other people is essentially when you're causing pain to a particular. I mean, you can't, I don't think halakha would recognize this type of a group entity. You're causing pain to Polak. If you're making a Polish joke, if there's, again, if there's a Polish individual and he feels hurt by it, so you really, that's really awesome. In fact, just an indirect way of expressing aggression against this person. But I mean, in general, if that's not the case, there's no people present, you're just making a joke like that, and nobody gets hurt by that joke, then I would say that halakhically speaking, that it's not us, because you didn't hurt anybody. The question, of course, would be, from a philosophical standpoint, whether it's correct in terms of perfection of an ego to engage in that kind of behavior. That's what we're discussing right now. The question we're dealing with is what people basically would refer to as put down jokes. Where everybody loves this kind of thing. As I always say, today, I guess the classical example would be Polak jokes. You can make fun out of Polak. Now let's assume that from a practical standpoint, nobody is being hurt by it. Okay, so let's assume we're living in a society where there are no Polish people. Which is conceivable. Still people indulge in this, and they get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. I think Lenny is concerned, for example, if you're talking about an American and you're making jokes out of, say, black, that's another target. Maybe that's a better example for us, because I think there's a greater attraction, especially for Jews. I think there's a lot of tension between Jews and blacks. And Jews, more recently, I think, have developed a certain hostility. I'm not saying it's against black people. I'm not saying it's unjustified. To what extent it's justified, to what extent it's not justified, I'm not getting into that. Then, what usually happens is that making jokes about that group becomes much more popular and acceptable. Now, let's say we're talking about that, where you have both factors. Well, first of all, you're making it in the confines of your own group, so you're not really... There are no blacks present, okay. But what Lenny's saying is, since you're living in a pluralistic society, to a certain extent, it is going to affect and have some practical effects upon how you actually treat black people. That's what you're concerned with, right? Freud maintained, essentially, Freud maintained that the idea of the joke is really a cover, you see? It is a culturally accepted device which enables you to poke fun out of someone in a manner that's just a joke. You see, where the aggression is covered. So, where the joke falls on its face if it's too blatantly aggressive. That's why certain comedians are too raw, for example. Like a lot of them today. I mean, they're very upfront, right in the open, and so on and so forth. People can't laugh at it because they can't mask the aggression. You see? But I'm not going to get into that whole issue right now. Now, we're not taking up the study of jokes. We're dealing with those classes of jokes, which we all would agree are aggressive. You know, the ethnic jokes, or whatever, what's the ethnic jokes, where you make fun out of a group, what you do is you take certain, what you're doing is taking certain characteristics that seem to be, you know, manifest among certain members of the group, and you, of course, what you're trying to do is take something which is an accent and make it fit into the whole essence of the person. That's exactly. You see? And then everybody laughs at it. Because why? Because as Mark says, yeah, you're right, Mark. Why do people laugh at it? People laugh at it because they enjoy other people being put down because it enables them to feel superior. So it's an opportunity to vent your aggressiveness, your essential aggressiveness, an egotism in a way which I guess we would regard as being despicable, because first of all, these characteristics of man are despicable: aggressiveness and egotism, that's what I'm saying. It's in line with what we've just been discussing, that the attitude that man has about his place in the universe is completely distorted. He should have a sense of how small he is in the scheme of things. And yet he takes the attitude of a master, as though it's his place. He takes the credit for that which has been done by somebody else. Of course, other people, civilization, but ultimately that's how it's brought us. Because nothing would exist without God. So man has a crazy, distorted attitude. So the whole attitude of egotism is crazy to begin with. But, it's even worse. In other words, to the extent that a person feels a certain ego satisfaction, which is in line with a reality, with some reality. Now, he has accomplished something. That's what I said. The thing what we find intolerable is when we find people who are completely pompous, who are filled with a certain sense of themselves, and they have nothing to base it on. I mean, like in their own mind, they think that they're geniuses, like a legend in his own mind, and they don't see it. Like, what's the guy do? Everybody knows the guy is a complete zero. He only got to the position where, because of a relative, because he married into a certain family, you see? And everybody around him is always complimenting him, and he's stupid enough to believe it. So that's annoying. It's very annoying for you. It's annoying when a person manifests that haughtiness and there's nothing to it. But we find it more acceptable if we regard the guy as being a genuine star. The guy's a real hero, or a tremendous football player, whatever, even though we don't look up to that, right? And even though we honor a person that is humble in that context, but if a person is not, and if you go typical, at least it's not that hard to take, because you see that he's accomplished something. You accomplished something? Okay? However, over here, what we're saying is that a person is not only indulging in these emotions, he's doing so in the most ridiculous kind of a way, simply. In other words, he's enabling himself to feel superior on the basis of nothing, just on the distortion of reality. Well, there's a few distortions over here. First of all, why should you? Let us assume that what you're saying is true. Let us assume that there is a group of people and they are as stupid as they're saying they are. So what should your attitude be towards that? How in any way does that make you a better person? If that is the case, then either you should have a certain sympathy towards them, or you should, if you don't feel that you should have a sympathy towards them, then don't have a sympathy. But you know what? What is the significance? What is the significance of this fact in terms of your own life, in terms of your own feeling about yourself? It doesn't reflect positively on you. There's a mistake. In other words, by pointing out negatives in others, it is as though this reflects positively on you. Is that not the case? Isn't that the mechanism behind lust and hunger? Gossip, what people, this is very closely associated, by the way, to lust and hunger.
Yeah.
It is a form of lust and hunger.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that ethnic judge is a form of lust and hunger in an acceptable kind of way. I'm not saying that the halakhically is lust and hunger. We're talking on the philosophical realm. Once you understand on the philosophical realm, so then you can see that you can have expressions of this evil, of this disease. I mean, lustner is a disease. And the punishment for lustner is the disease of leprosy. It's a disease. Halacha always has specific parameters to it. So in terms of halacha, it's tied in. You see, halacha can't make such exceptions. So, but it can legislate relations between chaveros. When you're talking about harm in a person, a form of harm, aggressiveness has got to be set up in that framework as against a particular individual. Okay, you're harming another person. You're talking about him, you're destroying his name, his reputation, you see? So you have to have a particular. But, if you write a novel and these characters are so real that people actually talk about the characters in a good novel, right? If you're talking about the character, you'd be criticizing the character. It's a fictitious person, you can't legislate. You can't say, luckily, that's what not. You're not talking about any particular person. Conceivably, it could reach the point. If a person You see, that's the case that the anti-Semitism throughout history, the Jews bring out the Jews for reality. And Money's point is well taken. That's not the issue we're taking up today, but it is well taken that if you're serious, you're talking about slander. You're not talking about making jokes. What we're calling is basically sexual jokes or whatever. But to go around to slander a group, yes, that could partake of Moshe Shemra, because now it does affect an individual. If you're saying that a certain group of Jews, let us say, Ashkenazi, Spartan, whatever it may be, it doesn't matter, partake of a serious defect, to say is that if a person constantly criticizes, but defames a certain type of Jew, if a Ashkenazi, Spartan, whatever it is, he means seriously, so now he's defaming in particular. So he's saying whoever's a Spartan is inferior. So that's a very real lesson learned. But we're not concerned about this for this discussion. We're talking about the question of ethnic humor where it's basically on the level where you're not, it's acceptable, so to speak. You're not really insulting anybody. The question is, though, from a philosophical standpoint. Now, what I was saying was that, getting back to what I was saying, that this type of thing to me, it seems to be catering to the emotion of Lashon Hara. Seems to be the similar mechanism, because in Lashon Hara, that's the phenomenon where you put down another person in order to elevate yourself. You focus on the defects of others in order to simply enjoy, you take pleasure in the downfall of somebody else, in the defects of somebody else, and as a result of that, you magnify yourself. In other words, that's mechave de klon chavero, where a person seeks to promote himself at the expense of others. He makes himself look good by making somebody else look bad. That is one of the most despicable things that a person can do. Okay? So now the question is, though, that is this the same thing? Even though I could show you can argue with me and say, okay, you could show connections. Clearly you could show connections, but do these connections warrant a conclusion? It could be that due to the fact that it is covered, it is disguised, it's very remote, maybe it's acceptable. I'm just analyzing what it does. Just because I analyze what it does doesn't mean that I come to the same conclusion. Would I treat it then in the same way that I treat Lashon Hara? That's the question out there. I come to the conclusion that really it's not good, because any time you're making fun and the objective of that is to put down somebody else, it's going to be harmful to the soul, because it's going to partake of these mechanisms. That is to say, the aggressiveness, it's egotism, because it's just, it is really that, you see, it does express that innate superiority. The person who does have a feeling of being innately superior, even though he can't show any basis for it. It's just, so therefore he fabricates something. He's Asian, he's a Jack, he's a Polo, I mean, whatever, so. It simply, it also partakes of that a certain type of ignorance, like a refusal to acknowledge the existence of other kinds of cultures. Partakes of that also, you see, in the sense that it's ethnic, you see, what's really wrong about bigotry is that it's really a denial of the essence of man. See, all these attitudes are based upon accidents, the guy's color and the shape of his face, etc. All of these things are really... You do get into a serious issue of violating the Torah, because the Torah says the Talmud Kimbara as a Adam. That everybody, on that basis, everybody is really, that's the Haftarech HaMokha, that everybody's really equal in terms of God's relationship to man. It's because man has Talmud Kim. It's a Shofech Dam HaAdam, for Adam Damo Yishafech, he would Talmud Kimbara as a Adam. In that sense, all people are really the worst. When you're evaluating the worth of man and the status of man in the world, in the universe, it's based upon the fact that this person possesses the Talmud Kim. That's his essence. And the Guf is the action. And the particularities of the Guf, when people get involved in particularities of the Guf, that's stupid vanity. I mean, it's ridiculous. That's akin to... To having a certain attitude of superiority because you're good looking, and forget about different races or groups. Just within one group, that a person who's good looking naturally feels superior to a person that's not good looking. And they make fun out of ugly people. Now, what would you say about making fun out of ugly people? You say that not only is it wrong, but it's stupid. Because you're picking on something which is totally incidental, accidental, and says that no reflection about you at all, there's no reflection about anything. What you're saying is that looks is really the essence. You're saying that looks is more important than chachma, or than the person's character. Yeah, I understand, but you see, we would reject that. You see how people are very inconsistent because they don't know the principle. Like if someone were to come in here and to make fun out of ugly people. Well, which is, by the way, people that engage in this type of job, you see, you're talking about people like ourselves that are refined up to a point. We're too refined to make certain types of ethnic jokes. So we do it at a certain level. We're not going to vote fun out of ugly people. We wouldn't do that because we feel too guilty about that. Yeah, but people that don't have that restraint, right, will take it further. So when they're making fun out of ugly people, they're basically doing the same thing that we do, you see? But they just, instead of making it Polak versus non-Polak or black-white, they're saying ugly versus good-looking, and they're making a lot of fun out of ugly people. Now we say that's ridiculous. I mean, there's nothing... Because what you're saying is, you're taking work. You're taking something which is all accidental and incidental, like looks, and you're elevating that into an essence. So that shows that you're basic. It shows that for you, the essence of man is purely something which is accidental. And the inner quality. Of course, what we make fun of the person because he's lacking in the inner quality. You see? Yeah, but that's not true, because we're making fun of the person on the basis of an external. So we're taking, what you're doing is you're choosing a certain external, you see? A certain external, which has absolutely no bearing on a person's real character. And you're being blind. You're being blind because of your aggressiveness and your desire to have a target that you can make fun of. You're being totally blind to the real nature of that person. By the way, this is really on many levels. It's something which affects us. In other words, we set up certain stereotypes and we become very close-minded. I mean, the Jews suffer from that because once you see, you find that sometimes you'll have this. Where a person is not, you know, thoroughly anti-Semitic, but taking a certain anti-Semitism, a certain attitude. This is where Lenny's point comes in. So they won't give you a chance if once they hear you, you know, people think it's a category. You're Jewish, they think it's a certain category, that's that. Yeah, but very often, sometimes when they get a chance to know you, in certain contexts, they say, my goodness, I never was exposed to this kind of a person, and I'm glad I was, because now I'm more open-minded, I have, more people I can talk to, I see that you have something to offer, and so forth. Now, we also do the same thing, because once you maintain that, you become closed-minded. And you're closing yourself off to different types of people. Once you start to stereotype a group, it's a good point. You will never, there are plenty of people out there that you can learn from, but you won't, or you can learn about the culture. There's things of interest. There's things of interest, but, you know, because you maintain this attitude of superiority and you close them off, that's it. You have a closed-minded approach, you don't even want to listen anymore. So,
he's supposed to learn from
everything. Yeah, Chacham, I'm learning from everyone. Who is a Chacham? One who learns from all people.
From everything.
Yeah. So therefore, it would seem that Eliot is correct, that when you're engaging in this type of humor, what you're really doing is you're treading on dangerous ground, I would say, on many levels, because you are indulging your worst instincts, and those instincts are aggressiveness, superiority, and negating a certain attitude of negation. It's also just, in a sense, it's promoting a certain hatred of people in general, because man has a certain hostility. There's envy, there's hostility to others. Every group has that. A certain hatred and a certain envy. Nobody wants to see somebody else succeeding. So you are doing that, you're indulging that, and you're doing so on the basis of things that are absolutely artificial. So it has nothing to do with reality. In other words, if you do find a group of people that do exemplify bad virtues and so on and so forth, for them it's appropriate, like Amalek. I mean, I'm not saying that there would not be a situation in which it would be correct, it would be appropriate to criticize them and even make fun of it. See, we did that last year, and I said I had all discussion about the one area, I said the brother Zari is supposed to make fun of it. Well, he was talking about different kind of humor over there. Yeah. I'm just talking about in general. Okay. I'm not saying that there's no place for humor, for scathing humor, because when you're dealing with things that are truly evil, and you have to make the point to others, humor could be a very good tactic sometimes, unless you have to know when to use it or not to use it. But then it's based upon an objective truth, an objective reality. But simply to engage in this type of a thing, for the reasons that most people do, and that is to artificially promote certain feelings, superiority, as I said, to indulge all of these emotions of love, of lust and hara and superiority, and to reinforce these feelings about your own place, on the basis of these artificial factors, I don't think it's a good thing. And I think it's causing tremendous hatred in the world. Because the hatred that we find in the world are totally crazy. They're totally, totally crazy. I mean, the analyzing is based upon this. It's based upon what? Based upon all these feelings, these powerful feelings that people have, fanatical feelings about other groups of hatred, which are based upon nothing. I mean, I'm not saying that there's no justification for fighting. There is justification for war. I mean, there are real wars that have to be fought. That's Muhammad al-Hashem al-Malik. I mean, there's real evil out there. There's real enemies. I mean, there's vicious that has to be fought. But most of the cases are fine that the people that are fighting other people. It's not because, it's not that they have, you know, they have the exact same philosophy of life. It's purely based upon accident. It's based totally upon accident. And this emotion that we're different and we're better and you're inferior. And it's an unwillingness to really look at the other person as a human being and realize that he's a human being and I'm a human being. We're all created beings. In other words, I think there's a truth over here. I mean, I think you partake of this, even though, obviously, I'm always defending you. And I mean, as a group, I think you do relatively speaking, more tolerant. I mean, even this whole, conflict, the black theory, the breakdown of relations between blacks and Jews in the last 15, 20 years, after all said and done, I think that, I'm not saying that we're without fault in the other group as well. I think that essentially it's more of the expression of the aggression of the blacks against the Jews, and the Jews are more reaction, defensive, etc., not that they started out to dislike blacks. But that's a different story. I'm not getting into a particular history, let's say that. I'm just saying that those who partake of this attitude, it's not good. It closes you off, and in a sense, it is a denial of the Talmud or something. And you do refuse to look at the other person as a human being. Give him a chance. And look at him as an individual. And then you'll see what his qualities are. You're putting him into a certain category. In a sense, you are dehumanization. You're dehumanizing him. Because if he's a human, you have to tell him all he can. So he's deserving of a certain... tell him all he can, he's deserving of a certain type of a chance, so to speak. A certain type of respect, let's put it that way. A certain type of respect, you can tell him all he can. Let's hear his case. Before, if you look into the matter, you see that he's a low-level individual, so he's basically a Pokemon therapist. He didn't find like the case where he said, Rob came to the town and he said, are all the people so ugly? What do you mean? What are you saying? I mean, there is a distortion because you are making fun out of the creation. You're making fun out of the creation. Now, you wouldn't do that. I don't think a person would do that with certain groups of species of animals at a time. You mean, right? I mean, this category don't fly. This is something which is created by God and he's going to study it. But when he does so, when he introduces that category in man, he's saying, this is something wrong with it. if you're defective. So then you are criticizing your creator. How can it be? It will at a certain point affect your whole relationship with God. But that's exactly the default of this type of thing. Egotism will affect your relationship with God. You're going to descend into a very self-centered, childish type of relationship with God, as opposed to the God of reality, that you're just another created being. There's a whole different attitude that one has. You see, if one has the proper relationship to God, you can understand why it produces harmful effects. Now, I'm getting back to Lenny's point about the practical effects. It produces. You see, I think Lenny's saying is correct, but it's not so simple. A person, I was only joking. Yeah, but there's no such thing as only joking. I mean, it does reinforce. In order for it to be a joke, in order for it to produce the effect, it means that on a psychological, you're denying your own emotions. You really have these emotions. And the reason why it's so destructive is because before there's such fighting in the world, you have to realize that when you're indulging your ego at somebody else's expense, you're underestimating something. He also has an ego. His ego is no different than yours. So just as much as you're having fun, to that extent, he's being offended. So that produces a tremendous feeling of anger. And that's it. You should know in human relations that certain things people won't tolerate. I'm not talking about philosophers. Most people are not philosophers. On the emotional level, it's extremely important to realize that people can't tolerate being disrespected. There's a word for it in today's treatment, this, to be this. You see? Yeah, they can't take that blow, certain blow. We've all experienced it on a certain level. You feel it's not that you haven't been treated properly, that's one thing. But you feel like your whole essence has been dismissed. And when people just totally dismiss you like you're not even human, so that has a tremendous blow. And conversely, you will realize that it's extremely important to treat people with respect. And when you disrespect people, you're taking, even if they don't show it, even if they may not be able to show it in the situation, and they're going to remember, and they're going to wait for their opportunity to get revenge. That's a big problem in Jewish-Gentile relations and so on and so forth. It's a very big problem, and it's a good thing to remember. The answer to the question of being beautiful and ugly is a separate thing, and that is that in most cases you attract to a certain persona. You're not really looking at the person. You look at the person and then you form a certain, what you're relating to is a certain image in your mind. Okay? So even people, you'll find, even people that are not that beautiful, but it's a composite. In other words, the personality goes into it. That's when man relates to another person. It's on the basis of a certain image. And you'll all know in your life there are many people, that friends or even girls, that you are very attractive. Even though you could say that from an objective standpoint, someone looked at their picture, they weren't that beautiful, but they had certain qualities that were manifested in the personality which made them very attractive. So usually that's the case. I mean, I can't talk about a person who can be so physically deformed that, we're human beings, and we can't help it. We have this a certain aesthetic element in our nature. But overall, it's not the most important. It's clearly not the most important thing. Okay, the issue is that we've been discussing that according to God, that I was saying that the mere fact that we're discussing the issue of homosexuality, the mere fact that a person has homosexual feelings but does not act upon them in no way brands them as evil, does not brand them as a Russian. And there's nothing, the person should not even feel that he has to be ashamed of those feelings, because these are things over which he has no control. I mean, I'm assuming that's the fact. I mean, whatever it was that determined it, whether you say that to a certain extent it's constitutional, which I'm sure it is to a certain extent, and to a certain extent it may be factors in our upbringing. I mean, I'm talking about psychological factors, environmental factors. There's a whole debate. It's not clear to anyone what the causation is, but certainly whatever the causation is, it is something over which the individual is essentially a victim. I mean, he has no control over his emotional life. I mean, in the same way that everybody finds himself at a certain point, you know, when it comes to maturity with certain types of desires, even if it's be heterosexual, each person has a certain prototype in his mind of the type of woman that he's attracted to, and within his framework of sexuality, different types of attractions and so forth. And the fact that you have those feelings is not something that you can hold a person responsible for. It would be absurd, because they were given to you. They were given to you. I mean, in the same way, it would be really regarded as absurd for Christianity to pronounce the instinctual desires of man to be evil. It's absurd. Because it's something which is part of the creation. It's been implanted in you. So how could it be evil? Now, therefore, I'm saying in general, but that's one case, but then I'm saying even in cases, I was giving the case for a person sitting Shiva, and has very, very strange and ambivalent feelings towards their parents, like a sitting Shiva before. Feelings of anger, resentment, and so forth. So I was saying that, I was telling the person that there's two things. There's the feeling itself, and then the fact that you feel ashamed that you have such feelings. And I'm saying that a person shouldn't be ashamed of the fact that they have the feeling. They should acknowledge the feeling and then explore it. I mean, just because you have a feeling doesn't mean it's true. So therefore, if you have the right to express the feeling, then you can explore the feeling, and then you can see for yourself what it's based upon and why it is not true, and then you can get over that feeling. In other words, when you have certain feelings about a person, that's why I'm saying it's bad to repress them. Because when you say the feeling always carries with it a certain attitude. Just as human beings, we don't just have strong feelings. If I dislike someone, I always have to justify it. You see, the brothers thought so for the dislike. A simple dislike, which had no basis except for the fact that the Yaakov favored him. See, but that feeling is always looking for some soul in the Gava. So the very first opportunity, that's why the next story is the dream. As soon as he said he had a dream, they hated him more. Because once you don't like someone, you can't admit that you just don't like them for no good reason. You follow? You always have to find out if you don't like it, then it's bad. That's part of the human makeup. You see? So feeling a certain attitude towards the object that you have a feeling for. So therefore, if you feel anger against someone, along with that is the idea that this person is deserving of the anger, there must be something wrong with that person. It's a very high-level person who doesn't look at it that way and says, I'm crazy, he's okay. Most people are going to say there's something wrong with him. You see? So therefore, if a person has very strong feelings of anger and resentment against their parents, it's a certain attitude that it's justifiable. That my parents did something really bad. They weren't good people, or whatever the case may be. That may not be conscious to him, but I guarantee you that's always going to be there, because you're going to ask the person, what is your anger about? You're going to have something to base it on. You see? So then he's going to start to tell you over how they treated him. Now once he's moving away from the arena of pure emotion, and he's now starting to justify it, now he can deal with the person, because he has a mind, and as he talks it out, you can point out certain things. One second. He forgot it was your birthday, this and that. Well, what was the situation? Where was he at the time? Was he involved in it? You know what I mean? Then you can bring in all, because what you're doing is you're isolating. You're isolating everything, you know, on your premises that everything should revolve around certain things, and you're blaming because it doesn't work. That's always the case. You see? Or you can find out that it is justified, you see, and then you can say that the truth of the matter is, you're right, but that this individual is not, you know, in that area had a weakness. But don't you have a weakness? I mean, once you bring it up on the table and talk about it, then you can deal with it. Because then you can say you're right, say you're forgetful. But what about other aspects of your life? And took care of you in other ways. And are you perfect in every way? The problem with suppressing it is that it's going to remain in the suppressed state, and it's going to produce the attitudes and hatred that it is associated with. Once you bring it up to the surface, and you deal with it as a realistic phenomenon, and you bring in all the other factors, so then you can deal with it. I'm not saying over here that a person just lives according to his feelings over here. I'm saying there are certain feelings, you see, that you can maintain, you see, that are appropriate feelings too in a situation. You're going out with a girl and you're developing positive feelings, so you don't want to suppress those feelings. Of course, obviously, even that has been done with stakeholders, but then you decide to marry this person and you develop a feeling of ahava, of love. That's a good thing. You want to nurture this feeling in that. Your feelings are just something. Even feelings have to be controlled, have to be nurtured, have to be developed. But of course, if a person has an inappropriate feeling, if he falls in love and he finds that this person is somebody else's wife, that's a feeling that he has to get rid of. You can't live your life with that feeling. So there's a way of getting rid of feelings too, you know. You have to treat every area of your life, your mental life, as sacred. But if a person should find himself with an inappropriate feeling, still it doesn't mean that he should acknowledge it. He needs help. You see, and he has to deal with it. He has to deal with it, and there are ways of dealing with it. Once the person comes to a recognition of why this feeling is inappropriate, he's living in the world of reality. He'll be able to get rid of it. He'll be able to deal with it. He'll see that it doesn't make any sense to have such a feeling. Just like in the case where he has anger against the parent, but he really doesn't know why, because he's never explored it. That anger was rooted in an infantile attitude towards the whole scheme of things. But it remains in the, you see, now that infantile attitude is going to remain with you as an adult, and it'll poison all your relationships until you bring it to the light of day, and now you look at that whole situation from the standpoint of an adult, and then you can deal with the feeling. See, the homosexual, the so-called honest homosexual who is committed to the principle of Torah, it's a very, very tough situation. Someone who deserves, instead of everybody, for some reason, everybody makes fun of homosexuals and gays. I mean, I don't know why. Except I'm not going to go into the psychology of that. I don't know why people have all these jokes about gays. Now, while we're on the subject of jokes, right? That clearly is a form of aggression, suggestion, and certainly an element of denial. In other words, the person has to distance himself from that phenomenon. Another reason which why I think that from a philosophical standpoint, these types of jokes where you target certain groups of people and put them down because of certain accidents, you see, I think it's also a violation of covered abuse. Specifically, there is covered abuse is a very, very important point in the argument. Very, very important point. That to diminish, that is true not just, of course, of Jews, it's more serious, we're in a different framework when you're dealing with fellow Jews, you have to reach them over. But that only applies to Recha, who is your friend in mitzvah, because we're all living according to the highest possible system of of human life. And at the point that Yada demands of us that we have an attitude of respect for Adam per se, because Adam is the Telem Elohim, that man is made in the image of God, and therefore you're not allowed to do anything which disparages Adam, because that's really a disparagement of God. So covered habrios is an extremely important principle, and when you are, what you're doing over here is you're really wiping out people. You're wiping them out with jokes. The aggression, verbalized aggression, and so forth. So from that standpoint, it's also something which is prohibitive. From a philosophical point of view, whatever. Be clear. Everything, I'm not talking about evil people, because the Torah says when it comes to Avodah Zarah, we buy them as Shemam. I mean, Rashi says that's one case where you have to employ humor, even a filthy kind of humor, to make them, to destroy Avodah Zarah in people's eyes, to disparage it. I am not talking about Rashayim, where it is legitimate to hate them and to disparage them, of course. I'm talking about where it's based upon accidental things. Things of color, or habits, cultural habits, etc. Stereotypes, which is basically nonsensical kind of thing. And where you're trying to boost yourself on the basis of things which are accidental to begin with. You see, where it's purely an egotistical response. Anyone who's living in that framework of ego is seeking to boost his own ego on the basis of certain accidents that he has, which give him a certain natural feeling of superiority, and in order to do so, it's got to be relative to somebody else in the world of comparison. Because he's not living in the world of the absolute reality. And the idea is true. That many firm people have these feelings of superiority, and they will take certain kutum or certain statements of chazal, which do indicate, which superficially seem to give the impression that the Jews are superior to other people. And you see, when a person has that feeling to begin with, obviously, then he finds a pasuk which seems to cater to gratify that emotion. I mean, that's it. For him, it's an absolute proof now. But interestingly enough, the Torah makes it very clear in the Vayom. I don't know why. It's one parsha. I gave shiur on it last year. I gave shiur to the community, women in the community, about this. It's a parsha that nobody focuses on, that God tells us specifically that we were not chosen because we are superior. Because it says, well, lo me'rub, not lo me'rub, of course, not because of your great class, but lo because of. You should not say in your heart. This is in Devarim. In Devarim, Peretz says, you don't need Chazal. Listen, Peretz says, Chazal, Al Tom Abu Vavcha. You're not saying in your heart. Bado for the Shem Ochecha Ushan Ufanecha. When God destroys them, destroys the other nations from before you. Leimar, it's a kafi having ani adoshem. That's the clear statement. Why? We went through the whole thing. Why do we have to say Al-Tomar? Al-Tomar always presupposes that this is what you're naturally going to, it's going to be a natural tendency to say this, because whenever a person experiences tremendous success, good fortune, divine intervention,
especially
at the expense of others, it caters to its innate, there's an innate feeling of superiority that everybody has. So you shouldn't say that it's because of the army of the sound. Because of my tikkun, as God done. That's how a person feels. A person feels, because naturally he feels like a tzaddik. So when things like this happen, when we win, when the Jews win, it's because we are tzaddikim, and they're Rishayim. Uberisha zagayim eila, Hashem orisha mifanecha. Lo v'tishkatcha, v'tiyosher levavcha, atavah l'reshis atarcha. It's not because of your tikkun, or because of the straightness of your heart. You see? It's because of the rishis. It's only essentially, as I said, you only have accidental designation. You're designating only because of an accident. In other words, the individuals who have essential designation, the individuals to whom God relates, are your forefathers. And we just happen to have the good fortune to be the children. To keep it out, keep it out. In other words, you have to recognize, but it's not you. You, insofar as you are concerned, compared to the rest of the world, if there were no phenomenon of the drift with the avos, then you'd be no, you would not be any better.
Sparim always says, chod avos.
Alright, the next question, Rav Yadata Tilov is a kach, Hashem Hotech, and Nosim Achaz Oroz, a kova hazos, the Rishka, the Am Kshe Oref Hotech. Not only aren't you tzaddikim, but you have a flaw of Kshe Oref, Am Kshe Oref. Am Kshe Oref. The thing is, no one ever gives Joshua from these cooking. You got to assure, today we're living in the world of it's the feel-good theology. It makes you feel good. Nobody, right? No one wants to get up there and make you think. Or make you believe. It's the only pluralistic of competing cultures. And the thing is, each group wants to feel that they're great.
Jewish pride.
Right, Jewish pride. And this is contrary to Jewish pride.
The dance club.
First of all, it's wrong to have an attitude of disparagement. For anyone who is homosexual, which is based upon the same attitude that some people have, to make fun of it, put down. Okay, but first of all, if the individual is observing halacha, then you have to have tremendous sympathy and admiration because he's on a tremendously high level. That means to say that he really has to suppress all of his the most powerful desires, the sexual desires. He really has to suppress it. And to deny himself sexual satisfaction in life. So that person is like a great, great tzaddik. And in fact, years ago, one of the guys in yeshiva had a relative who was dying of AIDS. And he wanted to know, whether he should be in the hospital, whether he should visit him, and when anyone dies, if he should be involved in the funeral, and so on and so forth. Okay, what's the question? Of course, he was homosexual, and so he was Russian, and all that.
I said, where do you find that that's the barometer for compassion? I mean, you have relatives that are not Shama Shabbos, and so you have relatives that are not Shama Shabbos, and you need to say that if they die, you wouldn't go to the funeral and whatever, and you're trying to find some trust. And I said, who's worse? Who is worse today? The homosexual guy who got AIDS, or the guy who's Machal Shabbos?
I think from a homosexual,
from a philosophical standpoint, the guy who's Machal Shabbos is much, much worse. Because what today, what is the big temptation to be Machal? Why can't a person keep Shabbos? To me, it indicates a tremendous. Now, in other words, the guy who's homosexual, that's certainly less, if anything, he's definitely been Machal Shabbos. You could say that he had no control. Time. How many Orthodox Jews today, you know about, really, unless they get married very young, how many Jews are really controlling themselves and not of being Shomer in terms of the Nida, Megia, things like that? Let's face it, you know, there's a lot of prim guys out there and prim girls that don't observe the laws of Megia before they get married. I'm just trying to show you that when it comes to the sexual area, Chazal recognized this is the hardest area to control. That's why there's so many restrictions. The Hakaka is built into the system. And heterosexual Jews that are firm and so forth, but if they don't get married young, or even if they do, as soon as they begin to associate with girls, you know, boys and girls get together, there's a serious violation. And these things become accepted. But if that's the case, how can you have an attitude of condemnation to someone who's homosexual? Of course, you have to condemn the behavior, and you have to encourage the person not to do it, but if a person is nishkal and he can't control himself and he does it, then why do you hate him? Why do you hate him? If that's the case, you should restrict yourself in terms of going to funerals and so forth, or in terms of being a compassion only to people that are completely observant. What about the people that don't keep Shabbos? In my opinion, the person that doesn't keep Shabbos in life today is much worse. And yet these people are all respected individuals in all different, you know, these various Jewish communities and groups and so on and so forth. Nobody sets that up. Nobody sets that up as a barometer. In other words, if an individual, well, let's put it this way, if an individual were to be running for prime minister in Israel today, where all the, it was excellent in terms of his political qualifications and so on and so forth, but he happened to be a homosexual, and the guy's chance of getting elected, or in America, for that matter, even today, his chances of getting elected are pretty nil. Okay? Now, but all these prime ministers, including Netanyahu, they're all avarianim. I mean, whether the guy's a kofer or not a kofer is a good question. The guy, do they believe in Torah? Do they keep any mitzvot? I mean, they're totally secularized people. So that's no problem. That's no problem. But the rabbinate in Israel would go crazy if there was Netanyahu is not a Shomer Shabbos.
No,
he's had exactly. He acknowledges that he had affairs with other women, etc. Whatever the person does, I'm not saying this to condemn him. You know, that's the reality. We're living in a secular Israel, a secularized society, state, and you know, whatever you have to do. We're only acknowledging him from a political standpoint. But I guarantee you, if it were to turn out that a certain individual were a homosexual, then he'd be totally finished. If he had, in other words, if it turned out that he had a homosexual affair, if that turned up, rather than a heterosexual affair, his life, his political life is over. What's the difference? But it's a serious issue. Homosexuality is a serious, serious, serious issue. I'm not denying that. But, I don't understand why that is to be singled out. Are we opposed to it because it's something which is disgusting, which we feel that it's disgusting, or are we opposed to it not because it's disgusting, but because it's outrageous? So this is, if the basis, which the proper basis would be, not because of how you feel about it, because it's also a serious issue, obviously a very serious issue. Mm-hmm. Sorry, but if that's the case, then there are very, very serious issues on the same level which we tolerate, which we don't get so crazy about. So it was a why over here. Why the zealousness in this area? The zealousness can't be a zealousness for Torah. That's what I'm trying to point out. What Lenny's saying is correct, that people feel emotionally repulsed, then they see that the Torah condemns it, and they say, aha, You see, the Torah is confirming that my emotion is correct. Okay? That's exactly how the person reads it, and that's false. The Torah does not prohibit homosexuality and make it such a strenuous prohibition because of your feeling, because of what you feel. You have to study the phenomenon and find out what is it about it that the Torah regards as being so evil. Eva, abomination, does not mean, Ray Chait made this point many years ago, that Eva does not mean disgusting in the emotional sense. Because if that were the case, then these people have a claim. You see, you have to realize the weakness, that why that's not a good basis. That makes it purely subjective. Once you're saying it's Eva, so it's purely subjective, so now let's say the taste, and then you're losing a tremendous opening. There's an opening there. Let's say the taste of the society changed, it becomes acceptable, and it's not Eva. The truth of the matter is that in today's society, that's what these people are pushing for. That's
right.
And the attitudes are changing, and you'll even find it, I don't know to what extent that it's a very strong feeling of revulsion. I don't know to what extent it could be overcome, but it does seem to change. I mean, it's much more acceptable now. But the problem, the difficulty is, though, that if societal taste should change, and you're saying it's tolerable because it's revolting, so how are you going to justify it? And then you're helping to make a case of Reformed Judaism that these things are based upon certain situations. And that when those situations are no longer there, then Judaism has to develop. Judaism has to evolve. That's their claim. That's the claim of Reformed Judaism, which is a false claim. But I mean, if you're going to take that position on this issue, you're really confirming what they're saying. And you're leaving yourself open to that. So Eva means from a philosophical standpoint.
What I'm saying is when you do hear people quote the punch.
From a philosophical standpoint. Philosophically, that type of activity is man. Given that within man, the sexual instinct, you see, should be subdued and controlled and only be satisfied in the framework of the purpose that it was intended for by God, and that is in the purpose of building families, you see, marriage and families. So then from that standpoint, to take that and to make it into an end in itself, an institution of taiva, purely for the sake of taiva, that's what is a taiva, that's an abomination. Because that represents man living a life, basing his life principle like a behemoth. That's why it's a Toeva. From that standpoint, it's a Toeva from a different standpoint that it makes no difference now what the taste of the society is. From a philosophical, because it represents the complete philosophical downfall of Adam. He's no longer functioning as a human being. As a human being, it means to say that he's established his seichel. It's telling all of him is the principle by which he determines his activities. And even the gratification of instincts is in the framework of a life which is based upon the fulfillment of the telling all of him. So in that framework, he satisfies his sexual instinct, you see, within the context of its purpose, of the purpose which God ordained for it. And if a person removes it from that context and makes it into a separate institution, so that's a nullification of man and his animal again. He's basically an animal, basically a behemoth. He's isolating the sexual from its purpose, and he's that would be true. That would be true of any type of a thing like that. You see, any type of an activity in which he's setting up sex as the ultimate aim of human existence. Where the sexual instinct is being separated from its intended purpose. Its intended purpose is within the framework of the family. Within the framework of Puruvu. That doesn't mean that every time he does it, he has to like the Catholic Mahabha. But it's in that framework. It has to be in that framework. Because I'm not talking about the realm of Halacha. You see, Halacha does legislate certain types of thinking, obviously. Hiruru. You're not allowed to promote certain sexual types of thoughts. That's called Hiruru. Therefore, many areas where the Torah does legislate what you were permitted to think about. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about areas where there's no halakhic legislation. So, for example, how you feel. The Torah doesn't legislate how you feel about your parents. The Torah legislates how you act with your parents. I said that many times, that you don't have to respect your parents in your heart. It would be an absurdity because virtually every person in the world, good or bad, is a parent. So, there's many people in the world that you don't respect because of how they live their lives. Now, if that person happens to be your parent, you're not going to, why should you respect the person who if he were not related to you, was living his life in such a way that you would have absolutely no respect for. Now, because he happens to be your parent, now you respect his way of life, and it doesn't make sense. But it doesn't mean to say that you have to respect them in that sense. Respect them only in the, within the framework of the Torah legislation, the activities of keep it out of the hand. It means that inwardly you really have a high opinion of this person. You don't have to have a high opinion of this person. The opinion of the person is like the same as like whatever you base your opinions of people on. If you respect knowledge and learning and whatever it is, whatever values you respect, and this person doesn't have them, so you don't respect that person in that way. But that's you still have to keep it up. You couldn't tell that to them, you couldn't insult them. You're restricted in terms of how you act towards them. Now what I was talking about, where I'm saying that when you have certain feelings which are not legislated, because the Torah doesn't legislate how you're supposed to feel about a parent or how you're supposed to feel about a child, and you find that you have certain feelings that, which basically scare you because it's not according to your ideal of how you think a parent should feel about a child. And I'm saying that the proper approach is not to feel bad about having those feelings. The causation of that is factors beyond your control. So it's not something you can say that's your fault because you did anything wrong. So therefore, that's a mitzvah, it's a reality. You have that feeling. Well, like you would have certain physical pain. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. What are you going to do? A person has other, but people are ashamed of that. The person develops a ball. He feels just embarrassed about it. The person has a wart, you know, in a funny kind of place. He says, "What are you embarrassed about? It's your fault." So acknowledge it and deal with it, and we'll see what you can do about it. That's it. The same is true with regard to these types of feelings that plague people. And that's why there's a lot of neurosis in the Muslim community, because people are raised not to have certain feelings. The education is not just with regard to how you should live your life, behaviors, but how you should feel. And then they make people feel bad for having feelings. And that's the leading cause of neurosis. There are certain feelings, you see. I'm not saying all feelings are appropriate. I'm saying that certain feelings are inappropriate. But just because a feeling is inappropriate doesn't mean that you should feel ashamed of it. You have to deal with it. Right? I'm not saying that therefore, I didn't say that. I said to acknowledge it and then deal with it. You see?
Dealing
with it, right. Now, dealing with it could be to explore it. So, for example, you're right. If the person finds himself in love with someone who's forbidden, somebody else's wife, or he's in love with a ship, so obviously that's your objective is, it's not just telling me that you can't marry her, but you're still in a state of pain. It's not good to be in love with her, so therefore you have to get out of love with her. And these things, you have to, there's a way of doing it, obviously. That's the goal. And how do you go about getting yourself out of that feeling? That's the goal. I mean, if a person has... first of all, a person should... You see, people say, these things just happen. It's not true. People don't just fall in love. I mean, it's like... there's a problem with therapists and their patients. It's considered... And today it happens a lot, but it's considered to be a serious infraction for a therapist or a rabbi... You have to say to that rabbi too. It was just what I wrote up in the Jewish Week recently, about a couple of months ago. I was in Arizona, I read about it. That's a major problem. But you have people who are in positions of authority, and then they're dealing with people who have problems, so those people are vulnerable, and they tend to have an idealized image of the counselor and the rabbi. A rabbi is a man who represents authority, and very often they tend to develop strong feelings for that person. That becomes a problem in the situation. Now, if the rabbi is on the highest ethical level, he's not allowed to take advantage of that kind of thing. But not only a rabbi, even a therapist, Freud, who was the chief of all therapists in the psychological area, he's the go-go in that area. He was very machbid. He was exceedingly machbid. The point is, though, that a person has to be very careful, because sometimes you do, this is something that if you become a therapist, and if you're a rabbi, you're a counselor, you have to, you know, you have to be educated and have to deal with it, because you will find yourself in a situation where you too may be developing feelings for the individual that you are supposed to be helping. That's a dangerous situation, because now you're part of the relationship. You're departing from the posture that you're supposed to be outside of the relationship, studying this person. You see, now when you're drawn in, there's a tremendous problem. I mean, first of all, you're going to hurt the person. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing is awful. So therefore, you have to learn how to recognize these emotions within yourself. That's a very important element in being a therapist, is that you have to call counter-transference. That what you're hearing evokes emotions in you. And once you feel that emotion, forget about the moral problem, but even the therapy can be biased. Because your whole interpretation of what's going on in their life is based upon what's going on in your life, based on your projection. You see, that's what they call a counter-transference. That the person evokes within you certain strong feelings. You see, now you're operating with certain emotional biases, so you've got to be objective. You're not going to be objective. You see, then you're just playing out your own feelings rather than being objective about the situation. So a person to help somebody else has to be exceedingly knowledgeable about their own emotions as well. But you also have to have discipline, and you cannot allow yourself to develop these feelings. Because now you're going to start to feel this person is going to develop tremendous admiration for you. You see? And maybe even fall in love with you. Now, when that happens, that evokes a tremendous feeling within you. If you get into that, you can't get into that feeling. You've got to control that feeling and not allow yourself to develop those emotions. If you don't do so, then you can't be a therapist. That's what I'm saying, is an example of a case where you have to control your emotions and prevent yourself from falling in love, so to speak. That would be a serious breach if a person were to do so. And then you have to disqualify himself. If he was honest, he'd have to disqualify himself. He'd have to go for help himself. Now he would do so.